Address of the President at the National War College, Fort McNair, Washington, D.C., 19 December 1952.
General Craig and gentlemen, you men are engaged in one of the most important studies that Americans can engage in today. You're studying our national policy in its broadest sense. Our national policy is not simply our foreign policy or our military policy or our domestic policy. It is a combination of all three. The international domestic policies which a nation follows are the foundation of its foreign policy. Unless the domestic policy is sound, you can't have a foreign policy. And its military policy also is based on the soundness of the domestic policy. What we can do and ought to do abroad depends on the kind of a nation we are at home. We are above all else a peaceful nation, and what we want most in the world today is peace, a just and lasting peace, a peace that will release the constructive and creative energies of mankind and increase the happiness of men and women everywhere. Our national policy, the policy we are studying, in all its aspects, is simply a policy designed to reach that objective. It is a policy for world peace. You who are privileged to study here have an opportunity that is available nowhere else in this great country of ours. You are given facts that cannot be generally made public. You can look at the problems confronting the United States in the world today, clearly and steadily and as a whole. I'm sure you appreciate this opportunity and understand how important this background will be in the positions of high responsibility you will occupy when you leave here. I talked to you today about this policy for peace and what our country has been doing to put it into effect since the end of World War II. There's never been a greater need than there is now to think about these matters clearly and comprehensively. We must try to do this with detachment and without partisan bias. The situation of the world is such that anything less than our clearest and wisest judgment may be disastrous to our future. If we look back over what we have done since the end of World War II, I think we can say that we have been successful in laying the foundation for a future structure of peace. Things which were merely principles in 1945 and only blueprints in 1947 and 1948 have now become established realities, growing and living institutions. We've done a great deal, and we've done it very rapidly in the past 7 years. Some of our policies have been successful, and some have not. But by and large, it can be said that we have created the basic framework that is necessary to resist aggression and to uphold the principles of the United Nations. Whether that structure will succeed depends upon a number of factors, including the degree to which we give it material support. But the progress we have already made gives us confidence that we can succeed. At the end of World War II, the people of the United States were anxious to return to peaceful concerns. We wanted to forget about the problems of national security and national defense. We were indeed too eager to do this, and in our hasty demobilization, we impatiently threw away a great deal of what we needed. A little more than 7 years ago, in a speech which I made in New York on October the 27th, 1945, I pointed out that we needed to continue to have strong armed forces. and a universal military training program. I said that we needed these things in order to enforce the terms of the peace, to fulfill the military obligations which we were undertaking as a member of the United Nations, and to protect the United States and the Western Hemisphere. To many people, these statements sounded like strange talk back in 1945. In those days, few of us realized that we would need strong defenses and trained manpower. Some people still don't see why we have to have universal military training. But the intervening years have proved that this was the right position to take in 1945. A new danger was then beginning to appear, a danger which has since become quite familiar. This was the refusal of one of our former allies to cooperate in the effort of the free nations to build a world peace. That nation, that former ally, set out to expand its own power by taking advantage of the weariness and the yearning for peace that were prevalent throughout the world in the chaotic aftermath of World War II. This threat was global. It was sustained and persistent. It included political subversion, economic stratagems, and military and diplomatic pressure. It was aimed at all the free nations, wherever weakness might appear, and most particularly at the nations of Europe and Asia bordering on the territory dominated by the Soviet Union. To meet this threat, we had to devise new plans and programs. We had to develop measures that were new, that went beyond many of our traditions and experiences. I think that we have met this problem, and on the whole, we have met it successfully. The American people did develop new measures to meet this post-war threat to freedom. These measures have by now become so familiar to us that many of us tend to forget what they are designed to do. Our first objective is to preserve peace in the world. Our determination to do that was very clearly stated, I think, in the same speech I made in October 1945, setting forth the principles that were to guide us in international affairs. I said then that we do not seek for ourselves one inch of territory in any place in the world, but that we are prepared to use our military strength to fulfill our obligations as a member of the United Nations. Along with this, I stressed our conviction that it is essential that there be no territorial changes which are not in accord with the freely expressed wishes of the people concerned, and that no government be imposed on any nation by force by any foreign power. That was said in 1945. We recognized at that time that there were limitations on what this country could do to make that declaration effective. We knew we could not prevent subversion or conquest everywhere in the world, but we engaged ourselves to stand firmly behind the United Nations and to use our resources to make freedom secure for ourselves and for others. Our first problem was to help the free nations strengthen themselves as rapidly as possible. The war and its aftermath had seriously weakened them. Destruction, economic chaos, hunger, political turmoil, all appeared to open the way for communist subversion. The human misery and confusion in Europe and Asia aroused communist expectations of easy opportunities for expansion. The free nations had to have new internal strength before they could resist communist pressure. In 1947, we moved to help the people of Greece. Their national independence was threatened by foreign intrigue, guerrilla warfare, and military pressure. We gave them military and economic aid. Greece did not lose its independence. The elements that were trying to destroy that independence were defeated. The Greek people recovered to stand beside the people of Turkey in defense of freedom and stability in the area of the Eastern Mediterranean. Next, we move to bolster the internal strength of the nations of Western Europe. By their own efforts alone, they were unable to recover from the terrible economic devastation of war. Communist imperialism, using political weapons, was moving rapidly to take over their governments. We set out to give these peoples economic assistance and a sense of hope and confidence in the future. Moving ahead another step in our program to keep the peace, we signed the North Atlantic Treaty in 1949. This joined the free nations of the Atlantic area in a pact which was something much more than a traditional military alliance. It was a permanent partnership in the task of maintaining and assuring the peace. It brought the countries of Western Europe into closer economic and military unity. These measures have, up to now, been successful. Never has the United States made a better investment in security. I want to repeat that. Never has the United States made a better investment in security. It has been said that we've been pouring money down a rat hole when we helped the European nations to recover. That is just as untrue as is possible for any statement to be. The peoples of Western Europe did not succumb to panic and despair. They did not yield their freedom to internal subversion or to outside intimidation. The peoples of Western Europe are not in communist hands today, and they're not going to be. The economies of these countries recovered despite the embittered efforts of communists to prevent it. Today, the military potential of these Western European peoples is growing. This is of tremendous importance to the world. The men and machines of Western Europe are a key factor in preserving peace and freedom. If they should fall under communist control, the scales of world power would shift drastically in favor of communist imperialism. You know, our productive capacity is 50% of the world's capacity. Western Europe has 30% of the world's productive capacity, and the Soviet Union 20%. If the Soviets get Western Europe, they'll be on a 50-50 basis with us, and that's the objective of our foreign policy now, to prevent that from happening. We've also had to meet communist efforts to gain control over the two great peoples on the western and eastern borders of the Soviet Union, Germany and Japan. Here, too, we've been largely successful. That part of Germany, not occupied by communist forces, and it is the greater part, has been enabled to maintain its freedom. We have helped it toward a position of full sovereign equality in the community of free nations. We hope that it will become an important part of the newly emerging United Europe. On the other side of the world, the communists have also been thwarted in seeking the political capture of Japan with its industries and its trained manpower. We have signed with the government of Japan a fair and generous treaty of peace. We have shown our confidence in the Japanese people. Now I want to call the attention of you gentlemen to something that's never happened before in the history of the world. For the first time, a victorious power, the greatest power in the history of the world, has helped its enemies to recover. It has not left its enemies to starve and struggle and maybe go into the communist orbit. It's helped them to recover. And that's the reason we are reasonably safe in this world today. It's never been done before. Study your histories. Another step in carrying out our policy of peace was taken when we joined with other free countries in the Pacific area in a series of security arrangements. This whole policy of ours met its greatest test when the communists attacked the Republic of Korea. That was the great challenge. That was the crisis that decided whether we meant what we said or whether we were really determined to support the United Nations and the concept of international law and order.